My name is Kat, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chips Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And now I get to introduce the speaker. Tonight, George M., also known as Big George, will be telling his story. I've known him almost since the entire time I've been sober. The best thing for me about getting sober is the longer you're in sobriety, the more the bigger fellowship you get, and you get to have these great friends. And George has become one of my, friends that I know that I can call on any time that there's something going on. I do love what he has to share, and so I cannot wait to hear more about you tonight that I don't already know. So come on in.
My name's George. I'm an alcoholic. Good night. Thank you. A little nervous. I don't even know why. I've told my story many times over the years, and I came in here at 23. Not a minute too soon. November 23rd, 1981, I picked up a white chip. Didn't even know what I was doing. I was just desperate. The night before, I had gotten, tried to go 5 days without drinking, and a friend of mine from Georgia State was an alcoholic like me. He's been sober a long time now. He's my drinking buddy. Him and his girlfriend were riding around Stone Mountain. It was in November, a little chilly, and I was drinking Tab, if you can imagine that. It's a soft drink. That's I've been drinking ever since, by the way, and with a brief stint with Diet Coke, and I made it 5 days, and I just hated myself and hated what I've been doing. I could not drink. If I took one drink, that was it. I didn't know where I was going to end up, what I was going to do. The blackouts were getting longer. The hangovers were getting worse and more horrendous. I mean, only another drunk can understand that. We know what it is to feel like it, to be strung out or be a drunk. And to back up, anyway. I made it 5 days, and then I started having sort of like hallucinations, audio hallucinations. The radio kept getting louder by itself, and I thought this is fucked up. So anyway, I told his girlfriend at the time, I said, I need to go to the hospital. And she said, why? And her father was a colonel in the Salvation Army, and she hated AA. She'd seen drunks come through the house, and that's the last thing she wanted to talk about. She was a drunk, too. And she goes, well, alcoholics taper off. And I said, I didn't know that. So she gave me a couple aspirins. She was cooking dinner. It's about 6 in the evening. She gave me a beer. And I chugged it, of course, and took the aspirin. And I felt a little better, and so then we had dinner. We went to the local liquor store and got a case, a couple of bottles, and really tapered off. So 3 in the morning, man, I'm like, hell yeah, shit works, So the next day, it was like, and the one thing struck me about Bill's story was dragging his mattress down to a lower floor lest he bust out through the window sash and all, because the horror of the next day is something I'll never forget. And I'm not really worried about, yes. I really like the way a friend of mine put this. It's like, I don't want the agains. I can't go through that again, And I'll never forget that day as long as I live. And that was my bottom. I looked in the mirror, and I'd never hated anything as much as I hated me. I was horrible, I had no, my spirit was dead. And I was shaken, and just, I don't know what to do. So I called Peachford, back then it was just one of the hospitals, and I talked to a woman named Pat Schultz, and she said, do you have any money? I was like, no. Do you have any insurance? No. And I'm a veteran. I could have gone to VA, and I don't even think about that. But she said, well, it was a Tuesday night, and I'm going to be at the place called Biscayne. Do you think you can go just for today without drinking? And I said, lady, I'll kill not to drink today. I mean, I was just like, I was done. And so that night I went to the Biscayne room, and it was cram-packed. And believe it or not, people used to smoke in meetings back then. And everybody had an ashtray. And it was like you couldn't see people because there was so much cloudy smoke. So you kind of walked in like that and smoked. And you got your ashtray and your coffee and sat down. And Pat was sitting in the very front. I'd never met her. And I said, and Chet G and a guy named Stan were chairing and leading the discussions. And I got, does anybody need to watch him?
Yeah.
And I just went up there and got one. It was like just, you know, automatic. You know, it was like, whatever that shit means, I want, you know. And, you know, but by that evening, I was already starting to feel better. You know, the cycle was already starting again, and I knew it. You know, where you start feeling a little better, and 2 or 3 days ago, but I was a binge drinker. And, but it was something about going in there, I was like, I just can't do that again. And I've been dating this girl, you know, it was sick as shit. And I kept raising my hand, this girl. And they finally said, why don't you sit down and shut up, and then we'll talk to you after the meeting. And I said, this woman, Pat Schultz, I said her last name, told me to come here, and she was in the very front, she's waving her arm. Mm-hmm. So that was the end of that. So that was my first meeting. And I saw some people in there I actually knew. And it was a very crowded meeting. It was a Tuesday night. It used to be called the Young People's Meeting. It isn't anymore because none of us are young anymore. So I said, we've had enough group. And two friends of mine actually started that meeting. But to go back to where I'm from, is I was born in Kennesstone Hospital, which is in Marietta. My father was an ex-Marine and an engineer at Lockheed, and he lost that job and ended up finishing out his career at General Motors. My mom was a nurse, and I had 4 sisters. Don't start crying yet. But I was the next to the youngest, so I like to tell people that I was a feminist before the word was even invented. You know, I learned how to cook, clean, iron, sew, all that stuff. But anyway, I love my sisters. They're pretty remarkable. All but one. She's a bitch. But anyway, I'm sorry. You know, she's one of us, but, you know, whatever. Anyway, so I got 3 older and 1 younger, 1 baby sister. And so I was born. And it's kind of cool, man, because if you go to Kennesstone Hospital, there's like a little statue, a bronze statue of me as a baby. Can you believe that? Well, don't. So anyway, that's a big line. They're probably glad you're rid of me. It's a screaming kid, get him out of here. So I grew up in for a while we lived in Marietta, and one of my first memories was, stark memories, was my mom crying and them fighting, and she was leaving, and she wasn't taking us, and that was not a good memory, man. It terrified me. Mom's leaving. Where the hell's she going? You know, she moving us to this guy. And that was traumatic, and I didn't realize how much, you know, effect that had on me. But that's a big deal when you're 5. So we left my dad. He'd been cheating on my mom. My dad was a sex addict and a rageaholic. And so we went up to my mom. My parents were from Blue Ridge, Georgia. You know, I've been there. It's beautiful. But when they grew up there, it was pretty rural. And we lived with my grandmother for like a year or two. I went to first and second grade up in Blue Ridge, and I liked it up there. It was different. And I remember they had these bowls of rice in the dining hall, sweet rice and regular rice. And I was like, what the hell is this rice for? Because there's a lot of poor kids that had nothing to eat unless they went to school. Appalachia was very poor in a lot of areas. You know, people don't realize how poor it was up there. I mean, you know, people didn't have nothing. And my mom was trying to raise 5 kids in a 2-bedroom apartment, and she was working 2 jobs, and she had nothing. She didn't have a college degree, and women back then, even with a degree, you didn't really, you know, you sat in the typing pool. That's how shitty they treated you. But she was barely making it, you know. And my father would come up every 2 weeks and come hang out with us, and he smoked like 3 packs a day. And I love my dad, and I want to see him, but he was a pain in the ass. He was so self-centered. I mean, where the hell I got it from? But it was just like, you know, it was just a stranger that would come up there and see us every 2 weeks. So finally, I think he had 5 brothers, and he was the youngest, and it kind of came down on me and said, you're going to raise them kids. You know, you can't just go run wild and do whatever you want. You got five children. And so I think that, you know, they came to me and they said, you know, you're going to do what you got to do. And so we moved down to Doraville, Georgia, when I was going into third grade. And that was exciting. You know, it was like, you know, Doraville back then wasn't a big city, still wasn't. But it was, Buford Highway was two lanes. If you went to Norcross, you were in the sticks, you know, basically. Roswell, Dunley, all that was the sticks. And I started, you know, elementary school, and then went to high school at Peachtree High School, which is in Chamblee, where they call it Dunley. And I hated that school because I felt like I was a piece of shit. I just had no self-esteem. And, you know, my father kind of rubbed that in because he was so critical of all us kids, you know. And I had learned, but there was a family of brothers that lived up around the corner of the Mullinaxes, and there was four boys, and they were being abused too, but worse than I was. And my dad was mainly rageaholic and, you know, psychological abuse, which is bad enough, you know, hypercritical. So I hated him pretty naturally. And even though we had some good times together, it's kind of weird. But these boys that I grew up with, one was my age, one was two were younger, and one was older. And they taught me how to be a man. Well, I was about 12 or 13 when I started, 11 or 12 when I started hanging out with them and basically living in their house. And, you know, I learned, you know, healthy, you know, positive things like stealing and drinking beer and staying up all night and playing cards and smoking and, stealing cigarettes and other things like that, you know, and fighting. And that's what I thought being a man was, you know. And we talked about, you know, women, girls, and the more girls you had, the more of a man it made you, see, and the more you fought. So I grew up with these guys and I did what they did, and that gave me a definition of what being a man was, and it was all wrong, you know, but I didn't know. And then I had my when I was 13, one of my brother-in-laws, my older sister, next to the old sister, he left for Vietnam in infantry, and he left a five of a six-pack of Tallboy PBRs in the refrigerator. I'm like, now looking back, I'm like, why the hell did he leave those? I mean, I wouldn't have done that. And I've been out running and playing and everything like you do after school, and came in hot, sweaty, thirst, dying of thirst, and she opened one and poured it in the glass, and she goes, here. I was like, I'd fucking drink anything, you know, so I chugged it. And it burnt, man. I mean, it burnt, you know. But then something else happened. I felt like this feeling, you know. It was like this glow. And all the fear and anxiety and all that stuff just kind of went away. So I started, you know, acting goofy and just, you know, I was already egotistical as hell because I loved attention. And so I just won all this attention. And they were laughing at me. And it was funny and cool. But I'll never forget that feeling. That, you know, Paul Newman, in a movie he did, called it That Click. I think it was Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. And I had that click. And then we, you know, ventured into drinking Boone's Farm. These are real high-class wines, you know. Mogan David 2020. There was a Korean guy, nothing against Asian, but there was a Korean guy that ran a magic market right up at the corner off Flowers Road. That didn't know you were supposed to ID people, you know, and we're like 13, 14. So we could buy cigarettes, and we stole the guy blind. I mean, we'd kill it with all this wine, you know, and he, sure, whatever. It was great, you know, especially if you're a budding alcoholic. So we'd go to the woods behind that place and just drink all this shit, and I'll never forget, I think it was called Applejack Boone's Farm. God. It tasted good, but it made you relaxed and sick. So that went on, and then, you know, some other assorted things that get you high came into play. And I remember a feeling of this one particular thing that has smoke involved with it, feeling a loss of innocence. I was like, man, I've done that. Now I don't feel innocent anymore, you know. But anyway, I mean, you know, I was on my path, and so... High school, my parents, their fighting was getting worse and worse, My older sister and my sister just older than me, my older sister went to North Georgia, and then another sister went to Georgia. And then my sister Mary, who had the boyfriend in Vietnam, they ended up getting married and moving up to Copper Hill, Tennessee. Not a pretty place back then. And but her husband Jerry, I really loved a lot, and I was really close to my sister Sissy. We all had nicknames. My name is Buzzy, by the way, but don't call me that. But anyway, no, you should. But so halfway through my 10th grade year at Peachtree, which I hated that place because it was all these rich kids and there was cliques, you know, and I hated that, man, because I wasn't worth nothing, you know. But I did play sports. I was played football. I was wrestled, and then I eventually got into martial arts, which I stuck with for quite a while. And so my parents finally divorced. My mom finally got the gumption to leave my dad. Finally, you know. Three sisters were gone. So it was me and my baby sister, and we're leaving. I remember walking out the door and my dad going, "You're leaving me too?" And I was like, "Hell yeah, I'm leaving you." I mean, you know, why would you even ask that? Because abusers do that kind of shit. You know, he was a caretaker abuser, but more abuser. And I was like, "Yeah, see ya." You know, and we moved over to Manor Ridge Apartments in Doraville, and it was like for the first time in my life, I was 15. I felt freedom. I felt like I'll never forget this. I woke up on I finished out my 10th grade year at Sequoia High School in Doraville, which I really liked because most of the kids there were lower middle class or you know middle class, but you know they weren't rich. And they ruled the school, and it was fucking awesome. You know, I mean, they were just cool, you know. And there wasn't, there were a couple of cliques, but everybody, you know, were trying to beat them up, you know. It was like, you know, nobody liked the cliques. And I decided I didn't want to play football there, you know, because I'd be playing against some of my best friends at Peachtree, but it didn't matter. Because I got into some other extramural things. And and I met my first love there. When I was a junior in high school, I'm going to back up to the summer at the end of my 10th grade year. I remember waking up to the song of a song called Bob O'Reilly by The Who. And if you've never heard that song, it's a really amazing coming out song, particularly for a young guy, for a young dude. And it's one of the big verses in his Teenage Wasteland. You know, it's Bob O'Reilly at the very end. It's just an amazing song. And I remember how I felt like this joy that I had never, that I hadn't felt probably since I was a little, because I was free. I freed my dad, you know, and my mom was free, and my little sister, and it was just wonderful, you know. Then my junior year, I fell in love with this girl who was a Puerto Rican girl from the Bronx. Actually, I was taking martial arts at Pine View Plaza and working at McDonald's across the street until about 10. Then I would hop the fence and come back home because it was our apartment was right behind that McDonald's. It's still on Beaver Highway. And ended up getting fired from there after 2 months for eating too many Big Macs. That's a true story, by the way. But they didn't say I couldn't. And they made you watch these videos about where their potatoes came from and all this happy horse shit. And I was just sit there and eat like 6 or 7 because I was hungry. You know, I was Jethro Bodine. And so that lasted about 2 months. They realized their profit margin was dropping or something. And I remember hopping the fence. I was walking up towards my apartment, which was at the end. There was an apartment building right here, and this girl standing up there, and she had these big curlers in her hair. And she was like, I thought, man, what the hell is that? You know, when you're from the South, you know, most girls, you know, I mean, you're Southern. I mean, we all, not that they all were the same. There's some good-looking Southern women, but, you know, blonde hair, red hair, you know, that was kind of like more, I just never seen anything like her. And she was she was Puerto Rican, and she was from Brooklyn. And so we didn't have a lot in common. And I was just enthralled with her, you know. And the drinking, I actually went through a period of time where I was doing really good in school, and the drinking kind of had I just wasn't really into it that much. And, of course, we're in this tour. You know, she wouldn't have anything to do with me for like 6 months, and I lost a bunch of weight, and I was teaching martial arts in front of my building. So I said, fuck it. You know, I quit chasing her. So then her little gang of girls would come walking by, and then walking by, what the hell's going on? Anyway, we got together, and for about a year and a half, and it was wonderful. It was a great experience. And they moved to Chicago, and I remember I got really depressed. And here came Mr. Alcohol. Yeah, it's like time to drink. And some other things that you put in your mouth and make you feel different. And so that kind of geared up again. Then I decided what happened, you know, and I'm not proud of this, but my mom had a 66 Dodge Dart. And we were a friend of mine named Dale Mila, who had played football for Sequoia and had real long hair though, down to his ass. And he was just a really good friend of mine. And we were in this car and we had a bottle of Canadian Mist stuck in the console of this, if you ever seen a Die of the Dark, you know, then you know it had like red vinyl interior. And well, I'm shit faced drunk. And we're doing donuts behind the door of a police station. I mean, genius, you know. And I remember there was this cop, the head cop there, Bill Adams. I'll never forget this. And he was a friend of mine. He reached in the car and just turned the key on. He goes, "Buzz, what the hell are you doing?" And so he kind of had to give me a DUI. At the time, I was 17. And so my mom and my sister came and got me out of jail, out of the drunk tank. That's one of several times that happened over the course of years. And we cut a deal with the judge, you know, because my mom didn't have any money. And I said, "Well, you know, all my buddies have joined the service. You know, I've been wanting to join the Army." You know, and he goes, "Well, if your mom will sign for you, we'll get rid of this DUI and you just go in the service." And I was like, because I wanted to, you know, I wanted to get the hell out of there. Led Zeppelin had a song called "Going to California," and I wanted to go to California. You know, and so I figured, and a friend of mine, I call him a friend, he kind of like rooked me into going to the Army, and Jeff Robinson, and so, but the easiest path to get to Fort Ord, California, which is in Monterey, was to go become a meteorologist, which is what I did. And I took this test, and it was like a science test, and I didn't score real high, and I have no idea how. And so I got to go to meteorology school in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, as the artillery battalion. So I get a boot camp and drinking. Everybody's drinking. I remember, you know, after 4 weeks of boot camp, they let us come home, which is kind of stupid. It was Christmas time. They let us come home for 10 days in the middle of boot camp. And so I found out we had liquor and you know, assorted drugs in a friend of mine's car. We're driving around, and it was just like everything revolved around, you know, partying. And doing that kind of stuff. And, you know, I got away with, you know, there were so many times I should have gone to prison, you know, for some of the shit I did, you know, like so many other people. But God really does watch out for fools and drunks, but only to a point. You know, you only get so many chances, and I truly believe that. It was a miracle I lived long enough to get sober. So the Army was kind of a blur. I mean, I did my job, and when we'd go to the field, we'd have to set up these weather station to send up a huge balloon with a radio transmitter on it and figure out, because what we did was we did corrections for the big guns behind us. We gave them this information, they made corrections, they have satellites on it now, and then in front of us was the infantry. So it was good to have an M16 with you, you know, in case they came through the infantry, you'd get to shoot back. I never was in combat though, by the grace of God. And but all my drill sergeants had been airborne rangers and shit like that, and they told us some interesting stories. Scary, and glad I hadn't been there. So I get out of the Army, and I have the GI Bill, so I can go to college, and I started going to school at DeKalb College, and started working at bars, because I was big, and, you know, had learned this stuff in the Army, and I'd done the martial arts thing, and all the guys that used to pick on me in this neighborhood were now wanting to be my buddy, you know, especially when you work in a bar and you're a bouncer. They're all buying you drinks, and you're the man, you know. And so that wasn't good for my ego, unfortunately. And we would leave. It was a place, Pogo, as I worked at. Me and Tim were talking about. And I was, Billy, if you can believe this, I was one of the smallest bouncers there. You know, the biggest, one of my best friends, he was 6'10 or 6'11 and weighed about 290. He had been a lineman at Jackson State. You know, these other guys were freaking humongous. And Pogo's is a very large place. And so we had 9 bouncers that worked on a Friday, Saturday night. And it was a lot of fun, man. I mean, you know, and I wasn't really a fighter. I mean, I wasn't really a redneck like some people we know. But but I mean, I wouldn't run from a fight. But it was like, that wasn't what I was there for. I was just there to have a good time, you know. And people would like, it's amazing, people would like, you know, come in the men's room for a minute and then have stuff, you know, tequila or whatever at all. And so that was my thing, you know. And every now and then you had a breakfast fight. But or a brawl. I remember one time, and I'll move on past this, but the football team from Georgia came in one night, and just so happens the same night, Tech's football team came in, and they were at different parts. This is a huge place, and the tech guys were down here and their girlfriends, and the Georgia guys were up here, and it was like, and we're on alert. We're like, man, if anything happens, this is going to be serious. You know, these guys are fucking badass, you know. And so back then, they served beer in glass pitchers, big ones. Trust me, I remember. And glasses, you know, so you'd pour your beers, you know, that kind of thing. And about about 12:30 at night, a glass of beer went flying from the Georgia group over to the tech group. And they saw it, man, it broke. And I was in a standoff with this linebacker, and I thought, I'm fixing to die. But somehow we managed to calm them down. I think we just kept telling them the girls were looking at you and they wanted to be with you and all that. But said, calm their egos down, and nobody got killed. So anyway, I drank my way out of that job, and I was still managed somehow to go to class, although I'd be shaking usually. And finished up my core stuff at DeKalb, and just started working in seedier and seedier places. You know, worked at a place called Uncle Tom's. It was a biker bar, and I wasn't a biker, and I almost got killed there. That was wonderful. $4 an hour. You know, just stuff like that. It was just getting more and more progressive. And I had a real bad car wreck in 1980. My dad helped me get a Dodge Challenger. And back then, that was a muscle car. It would haul ass. And it was more car than I needed. And I've been working all day, and somebody gave me a certain kind of pill one night. With my drinking on the way home, I fell asleep. Hit a telephone pole, going about 60, dead on. And the two things that happened, the thing that caused the wreck was being drunk and passed out. The thing that saved my life was being drunk and passed out, because I was so limber that it didn't break it. It broke my, it messed me up, but it didn't kill me, obviously. And my friend Greg was thinking about becoming a police officer, so he took me to Brown & Brown. That's the big storage place where the wreckers go and take cars, and he wanted me to see that car. This is 2 weeks after the wreck, and I fainted. I mean, that thing was a big V, and the engine was sitting in the passenger seat, and it was torn to pieces. And he goes, "See that blood in there?" And the snapped steering wheel, that was where your nose was, your face. And, you know, by the grace of God, I lived. And that, you know, just, you know, and more of my friends were kind of just staying away from me. Family, it was getting worse between me and my mom, because I was stealing from her and stole her car one night, broke her axle, and she didn't have any money. You know, and I'm just being this guy who just, I'm a drunk, you know. And life is getting more and more desperate. And I finally, you know, got to the place where my blackouts were getting longer and longer. You know, the longest blackout I had was like, this is right before I quit. We're up in hell on drinking in October, and Oktoberfest. And I drank myself sober, but I was coming in and out of consciousness. Drank myself sober. It's crazy. Only an alcoholic can do that. I thought I was sober. But I remember I'd black out, and then I'd come to in the middle of a huge barroom brawl. And then I'd black out, and I'd be somewhere else. And then I woke up, though, underneath a truck behind the Habersham County Police Station. And it was freezing cold. I had like a white beater t-shirt on with blood and jeans and boots. And I don't know where I was. And I started walking, and they had like a place where they were playing bingo. In this, I can't remember the county seat of Habersham County, but I went up to get a hamburger. This is really sad, so you can cry if you want. But I'm eating this hamburger, and the mustard's running down my arm. It's really tragic. You know, and this little kid, I thought I was bleeding. Something was wet on my leg. I looked down, a little kid was squirting me with a squirt gun. I was like, what the hell are you doing? I was the victim, you know, obviously. I was like, get the hell. It was like a gnat. I'm like, get the hell away, man. He's squirting me with a squirt gun. Damn kid. But anyway, a cop came up, and he goes, you know, where do you live? I said, in Atlanta. I was basically staying with these people who didn't want me there. And managed to talk to these four young guys that were closing down a store to driving me back to Atlanta, to Buckhead, at Brookhaven. And lied the whole way, telling them I was going to give them all this money and booze. It was all lies. And, you know, but I was just going, and I personally was a friend of mine. I was happy horse shit, so they wouldn't beat the hell out of me. And we get to, I was working at the Buckhead Cinema Draft House, and which is, I think, the Roxy now, whatever. And I said, I don't have any money, but I got some wine. I got a net. So anyway, they leave. And so up, I get up to the place where I'm with Bill and Nancy trying to, I tried to quit. I made a valiant effort and couldn't. And that's when I hit my true bottom and came in. I was like, if I do this anymore, I'm going to shoot myself. And I remember that thought vividly. I knew I would do that because I couldn't take it anymore. I just could not take it one more day. So anyway, I'm in a sobriety. I'm at the Biscayne Room. And they used to have a thing at Biscayne where they would do a three-day ordeal for about the first couple of two, 3 years I was sober. And anybody could come in there that was a drunk, man or woman, and stay there for 3 days. And we'd clean you up and you'd go to meetings and we'd give you this called Maggie Concoction, who ran the place, Maggie Harrison. It was orange juice, yeast, for some reason, and honey. And we give that to them. You know, I guess it was to make you sick enough to we even want to have another drink. I don't know. But I stayed with people constantly. And there was one night I stayed with a guy. I was about 6 months sober, and his name's Rusty J. Everybody knows Rusty. And I was 12-step Rusty. I stayed on the couch while he scared the fuck out of me for 3 days, part of my language. He's paced, third and fourth. I didn't know what his deal was, but I was scared. He was coming off like six different drugs, medications, and he had other issues. And so, but he stayed sober. And I remember getting my first year to, and we went to halfway houses, man. We did all kinds of stuff, man. We just constantly service, do this. I was just doing whatever the hell I was told to do, man. I just did it, you know. Because by then I hated alcohol so bad for what it had done to me. My mind was gone. I could barely write my name. I shook internally for about 9 months. You know, I quit shaking outside after about 2 or 3 weeks, but I remember shaking internally, trying to light a cigarette, you know, and it was bad. But anyway, people like Mike Kerbo and Hal Collier and Hal Calhoun and Hal Foster and all these people, man, just Billy B. I mean, we're there. Jerry Benefield, one of my dearest friends, you know, and they were just Steve Reamer. You know, we were sitting in the back of the Biscayne Room until 2, 3, or 4 in the morning talking. And that saved me. You know, y'all saved me. It was the people that saved me in the beginning. Because I needed to know that y'all felt the way I did. I was so terrified of everything anyway. Because you took the alcohol away, there was a scared little dude, man. I was. I was big, but I was terrified. Anyway, I remember my first four step. It was 3 pages long. That's about all I can remember, really. And there was one thing in there, I'll never forget this. My sponsor, Mark, I had two sponsors, Doug Lauer and Mark Truitt. And Doug's passed on now, but Doug was an old acid head from 14th Street that had, I don't know how many shock treatments, but he turned out to be one of the most spiritual, wise people I've ever met in my life. And he saved my life. I could be crazy as shit, and I was in my first year or two. I was batshit, but I could tell him anything, and it was cool. He was just like, yeah, I understand. And I needed that. I didn't need a hard ass. I got what I needed. I did my first, this fifth step with Mark, and it was one thing, and it was a molehill that I made in this huge mountain. And something I did when I was drunk. It was so out of character for me, but I was in a sordid place. I did something kind of sordid, you know. And, well, I thought I did. And I didn't really remember, but I thought I did. And so I tell Mark this thing, and I'm like scared to death. And he falls over laughing. I'm like, what the fuck, man? This is serious. You know, this is a big deal, you know. And he goes, listen to this. And then he tells me this thing that mine paled in comparison. I was like, I was just aghast, you know. I mean, this was really, yeah. Anyway, so I'm not going to go into what it was, but you can just imagine. So, but it was like that something that did something to me. You know, I shared that part of me, and I was like, you know, I was in so much pain. It was like I have to do this, you know. And this came back then. You worked the steps. I mean, you did what you were told to do. You didn't, you know, you didn't own a flop house. Trust me, you know. And We used to have counselors out here in Roland B, who was, I think, a Marine drill instructor. We'd come in here. If you were laying down that thing, you weren't laying down long. And Maggie was like that at the Biscayne Room. And here comes my first year. Well, I went on and kept working the steps, you know, looking at my character as much as I could because I was so screwed up. I mean, you know, I mean, I know what my character defects are. I'm lazy as hell. I lie. You know, I'd say things to pump myself up because I don't feel like I'm worth a shit. I was always sitting on women because it made me give me some self-esteem. You know, anything that would give me made me feel better than what I felt like. You know, and that can happen today. I'm not hitting on women, but I mean, the feeling. You know, things can be going great. I have a bunch of money in the bank and all that kind of thing. And what? And I'm not lying. Truth meter. But anyway, it's part of the disease, and I got to remember. That's why I keep coming back, because this disease is lethal, progressive, and it will not go away. It's never going to go away. I might say, you know what, man, I'm sick of it, or whatever. And I've done that for periods of time, and when I just didn't go to meetings or I did something else, and it was like I started getting really, really miserable. How far I used to call it stark raving drunk. Because I get bad shit. You know, without, you know, a solution to this dilemma, you know, then I'm hopeless. And the drink at some point seemed just as natural as taking a breath. And I haven't done that, you know, since I've been here, since 81. Alcohol hasn't crossed my lips. Except once, accidentally. I was at a Jimmy Buffett concert, and I ran out of Diet Coke, and some girl handed me a drink or something. He goes, "This doesn't have alcohol in it." It was a Bartles and James, and that shit did have alcohol in it. I took a chug. I went, whoa, because I remember that feeling. And I said, I can't drink that. And I called my sponsor crying. He goes, "You need to get drunk?" "No, then forget about it." So I did. I didn't worry about it. I mean, I'm not going to make a huge big deal out of something that was an accident, you know. And if I was going to go get drunk, it wouldn't be that. You know, it'd be something else. And I'd be dead, probably, most likely. So my first year came up, and I'll try to wrap it up, but it was... No way to describe it. Your first year for everybody, it was just magical. It was just, you know, the place was packed. I'm not because it was me. It was because it was birthday night, and I was like, I had a year. I think I was the only one sober. I can't remember. But my sponsor, Doug, gave me my chip. My family was there, except my dad. He had called, and wanted to know if he could come. Because my uncle, I almost forgot this part, Alton, had been sober in AA at that point about 19 years. He was grandpa down at the Terror Club, Alton M. And he's the one, I called him to borrow some more money from him for another DUI, and he goes, "Well, you didn't pay me for the last one." He goes, "By the way, you know, they have young people in AA." I was like, "How dare you? I live with my mom, and everything I own's in a little bitty box, but how dare you suggest I go to AA before it's over?" And so I told my story at his one of his birthdays when I was 6 months sober, scared shitless. And but I remember sitting there, I told my dad, he said he was proud of me, and that was a big deal. And so my mom and all my sisters are there, and my mom's, you know, she's still leery of, she don't quite trust me yet, but it was huge. And I remember I got that blue chip, and it was amazing. To predate that, every chip I got, except for my white chip, up, you know, silver, red, yellow, green, up until my blue chip. There was a woman named Marianne Day. Tall, redhead, good looking. There was a dance here. I was about 3 months sober, maybe 6 months, and I was scared to dance because I hadn't danced so drunk. And she goes, "Come on, go dance. No, I'm good. And finally, a slow dance came on. And we slow danced, and you couldn't get me off the floor after that. I mean, because it was just, I was hard. Then, you know, so every chip, she would give me my chip. And she'd go, "Just wait till you get a year. You just wait till you get a year." I'm like, "Hell yeah." So, I mean, but that was God doing, you know, that was God working through her. And so I get the year, and Doug gives it to me, and then she was married to my best friend. I was like, "Well, that kind of sucks." But it didn't matter, because it was just the way it worked. And you know, the thing about, you know, people who have 20, 30, 40, 50 years sober, it's because they didn't drink and they didn't die. But I've known people, and I've been in this place where I was suicidally depressed because I have suffered from depression. And thank God for good medications. I'm not going to go way into that, but, you know, I was ready to kill myself at 9 years sober, 10 years sober, because of depression and anxiety. But a good friend named Big Carl said, "You know, George, there's a lot of higher powers out there, and doctors can be higher powers." And I found a doctor that saved my life. Without, you know, I wouldn't get a drink or nothing, but I would get to where I didn't want to live anymore. And it had nothing to do with the steps either. I was just not on the playing field. The steps are designed to deflate my ego to a point where the light, the sunlight of the Spirit can enter me. and work through, but I got to give it away, you know, because it's like a dam. If you just stop it, you know, okay, I got it, I'm good, it'll fade away. I've learned that the hard way. You gotta be able to sit down with somebody who's hurting. And I'm suffering a lot of addictions. You know, I'm suffering from 8 different addictions. That's what's been revealed to me, like Bill talks about it, since I've been sober. And I'm not going to talk about them, but I mean, they were just where my path led me. And but if I hadn't gotten sober from alcohol, none of that would have happened, because I would have been dead. So it was just, you know, God, you know, showing me, helping me grow in those areas. But there's a lot of things I can sit down with somebody in a lot of different areas and share with them and give them strength and hope because of my experience. That if I hadn't gone through that, I couldn't do it. It's like going up to a heart surgeon that had had someone pass away and go, man, I don't know how that feels. That happened to me. I can't do that because I'm not a heart surgeon. But I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, and I've been through these other things, and I've been through the depression. And so my path just takes me where it needs to take me. But I've got to just trust God. I got to remember, this is a day. You know, somebody said something real poignant not long ago. He said, you know, I can't stay clean on yesterday's shower. I can't stay sober on yesterday's sobriety. I mean, it's a good thing. It's the experience, you know, and it gives me more internally. But what am I doing today to enhance my sobriety? And there's things I do on a daily basis, you know. And when I've gotten away from those things, even if I didn't drink, you know, other things will take its place. And that's where you can get in big trouble. That it is, it's not a part, there's no part of this that's spiritual. It's a spiritual program. You know, it's designed for us to get closer, in my opinion, to my higher power, which I call God, you know. And my first higher power was the group. Then it was this huge oak tree that was up in Alcoa Falls. But it came back to being the group. And then I just slowly developed a relationship. And I didn't even know what it was, but I knew it was good. And I needed God, good orderly direction, because I had none. And y'all say, you know, if it wasn't for this program, I wouldn't be here talking. I would have been dead at 23 or soon thereafter. I've had so many cool, fun life experiences. I mean, too many to even count. You know, it's been unbelievable. But it's been really, really painful, too. There's been days when I've cried my heart out, you know, for different things. And finally, both my parents are gone now. My mom and my dad. Losing my mom almost killed me, because I was real, real close to my mother. I don't know if it's a Southern boy thing or I'm part Scottish and American Indian. And it didn't matter. My mom was wonderful. She saved us, man. She was the one who gave us love in the house. And for 2 years, man, I was in so much pain, and I couldn't get over the grief, but I finally got in touch with it. And it's hard. Why is it hard? You know, the program is simple as hell. I mean, all you got to do is work steps, but it's hard because our ego and pride doesn't want us to do it. It's like, I don't want to look at this shit, man. I mean, some of it's really ugly, you know, but it's the only way. I have to take inventory and then ask God to take away these things that I'm driven to do. And it's funny, whenever that happens, good things just seem to naturally come in. It's just, to me, it's just, you know, the way of the Spirit. And that's really about it. And I've made so many friends. I still go to Biscayne. And, God, I mean, I was really nervous because I thought there was going to be really cram-packed in here tonight. And, you know, that's the ego. Anyhow, I was like, oh shit, people are going to be calling me out of work. But it's like, it worked out exactly the way it's supposed to, as it always will, you know, whether I'm okay with it or not. You know, it's the way, you know, the universe really is unfolding exactly the way it's supposed to. And that gives me peace, and it gives me serenity, and it gives me hope, because this is hope, and it's saved me in every way you can possibly imagine. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, George. I appreciate you telling your story. Meteorology school, really?
Yeah.
You?
Damn.
Okay, well, thanks. I'll make sure I have my umbrella.
face.